Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program. The Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools are here every Saturday to defend and to promote public education. Now, as you probably realise, that's got nothing to do with private education. Public is public and private is private. And we believe that public education should be the only one that gets public money. But we know that's not the case, of course, and everyone is saying how unequal our education system is, but nobody's prepared to do anything about it. Particularly the Productivity Commission, who's now getting themselves interested in what actually goes on in classrooms. That's politically safe, isn't it, to have a go at teachers? So the Productivity Commission has been suggesting that perhaps teachers should share lesson plans. They have all sorts of ideas about this. But the Australian Education Union points out that perhaps they're missing the mark. So here is Andy to tell us about these issues.
Thanks, Jean. Helping Australian teachers share lesson plans could improve stagnating student results, Productivity Commission says. A national database of lesson plans was one of the recommendations of the fourth interim report into how to lift Australia's flagging productivity. This was published on Monday, the 11th of August. A national online database of lesson plans would help teachers cut hours from their weekly workloads and help reverse years of stagnating student results, the Productivity Commission says. The Commission's fourth interim report on how to lift Australia's flagging productivity focused on building a skilled and adaptable workforce. NAPLAN test results show one in three school students don't meet minimum literacy or numeracy standards, and Catherine DeFontenay, one of two commissioners heading the inquiry, said, "Anything that improves our foundational skills in schools is going to have the biggest impact on productivity." The Commission said it repeatedly heard during consultations that the tools and resources available to teachers varied between jurisdictions and sectors, while not all states and territories had developed lesson planning materials to share through a database. The Commonwealth should invest and promote a single online platform containing the materials, the report said, with the understanding plans would be adapted for local contexts and for the wide range of students' abilities. The Commission also said the federal government should take the lead in devising a national approach to education technology in schools, including tools using artificial intelligence. Effective implementation of both reforms requires collaboration and buy-in from state and territory governments, school sectors, school leaders and teachers, the report said. DeFontenay said the inquiry had revealed a lack of coordination around how to use AI in the classroom. What we found is that all states are on a journey. A lot of them are at the stage of trying to ban the use of Gen AI with various levels of success. While some state school directorates are focused on the risks, others are developing their own Gen AI tools, including EduChat in New South Wales. Teachers are in a very difficult situation right now, DeFontenay said. All continue to experiment and try out different technologies, but in the midst of the fear, there is lots of potential as well. For a kid who is struggling, AI can tailor the next question based on how they are doing on earlier questions, and then give them work that targets their weaknesses. There's a lot of potential, but there are always risks. This has to be a collective agreement in terms of how to proceed. A week out from Treasurer Jim Chalmers' Economic Reform Roundtable, the Commission also recommended easing regulatory restrictions around the jobs Australians are able to perform, which it said were exacerbating skills shortages. They should start by considering occupations, including motor vehicle repairers, painters and decorators, and hairdressers, where OERs, occupational entry regulations, apply in only some jurisdictions and are not demonstrably improving outcomes. DeFontenay said it was not a question of doing away with minimum requirements, but pushing back against creeping credentialism. It's more a question of proportionality. Audits are a good example. Right now, the level of auditor requirements are the same as if you are auditing BHP or a small enterprise. We think there should be a lower tier risk of license with simpler requirements, she said. In aged care, the demands and expense of educational requirements could be a barrier to someone with a natural aptitude, DeFontenay said. We don't want to see people who are really suited to this type of work prevented by excessive entry requirements. And in particular, we'd like to see in remote communities that it's easier for people to receive culturally safe care from people in their communities. The interim report also proposed initiatives to boost the skills of those already in the workforce. The Commission recommended providing financial incentives, potentially in the form of a tax credit, to small and medium-sized businesses who invest in training their staff. The report also backed better recognition of prior education and making it easier for students to claim credit for other study. AI is very much on everyone's minds, but occupational change has been a big feature of labour markets here and overseas, De Fontenay said. We need to prepare people to change occupations when their preferences change or when their professions shrink or evolve. Back to you, Jean.
Well, here's the AEU's response.
Thanks, Jean. Productivity Commission misses the mark. The Productivity Commission has recommended the wrong solution with its suggestion in a newly released report that off-the-shelf lesson plans should be developed for teachers to help them save time and teach outside their areas of expertise. The Australian Education Union said the Commission had correctly identified unsustainable workloads and teacher shortages as major issues in school education. But AEU Deputy President Meredith Peace said teachers wanted a significant cut in their administration workloads so they could spend more time on lesson planning and working with their colleagues to meet the individual needs of their students. They also wanted real action to end the teacher shortages impacting on all schools, and particularly so that teachers didn't have to teach outside their area of expertise. Research conducted as part of the National Inquiry into School Education found off-the-shelf lesson plans were the last thing teachers said would help them to lift results. The top priorities of teachers were additional classroom support, more teachers, and intensive tutoring support to help children at risk of falling behind. Governments need to listen to the profession and respect their experienced and informed views about what is needed to lift results, Ms. Peace said. The needs of students have never been more complex and diverse, and over one quarter in public schools have a disability. Teachers know that off-the-shelf lesson plans aren't what they need to meet the individual needs of students. They need better support inside and outside the classroom and a dramatic cut in the excessive administration and compliance workloads that are dragging their focus away from their students. Teachers want what students need, and that is why we have been campaigning to end the underfunding of public schools. The new investment secured in agreements between the Commonwealth and state and territory governments must be invested in ways that make a real difference to every child and every teacher in public schools. And that sounds pretty good to me. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, they say it's the economy is stupid, but of course when it comes to education, perhaps it's the funding stupid. So here we have a very interesting article from the Australian Education Union. They're prepared to demand more funding for public education.
Thanks, Jean. Single largest lobbying event ever at Victorian Parliament targets public schools funding cuts. More than 100 public school teachers, school leaders, and education support staff will undertake the single largest lobbying event ever at Victorian Parliament today, with over 45 meetings with Victorian Labor MPs to demand the state government reverse their public school funding cut. Public school teachers, school leaders, and education support staff will meet with their local state Labor MPs and ask that they join the public school staff in their electorates to demand the Premier keep her promise and deliver full public school funding, Australian Education Union Victorian Branch President Justin Mullaly said. The Premier made a promise in January this year to deliver 100% of the schooling resource standard to public schools. But what she didn't tell Victorians at the time was that her government had no intention of delivering on that promise in a meaningful way, Mr. Mullaly said. In April 2024, the state government had already decided not to deliver any additional funding until 2031, meaning at least $2.4 billion would not be delivered to our public schools. Victorian public schools are the only schools in the nation in this situation. Right now, Victorian public schools are the lowest funded in Australia, and every school in the state is affected. That means the learning and well-being of every student is impacted. Full funding delivered without delay would enable schools to better meet the diverse needs of all students, improve learning outcomes, and guarantee that every student in every classroom has a fully qualified permanent teacher. Chronic workforce shortages are leaving students without the support they require, with too many missing out on one-on-one assistance, especially those who need extra support. Victorian teachers are the lowest paid in the country, with education support staff and school leaders undervalued. Not recognising the worth of school staff goes hand in hand with the underfunding of our schools. Every single Victorian Labor MP should care about this, especially if they want to call Victoria the education state. The Premier needs to reverse these funding cuts. Our students, their families and the profession demands it, Mr. Mullaly said. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you, Andy. The Victorian Labor government is pretty good at breaking its promises, isn't it? But let's have a break.
Looking for an easy way to keep up with your annual 3CR subscription? You can now set up an annual debit from your bank account or credit card, and once a year your payment will be automatically deducted. You can cancel at any time and you'll get a reminder each year before payment. Be a constant supporter of Melbourne's precious independent community radio station and set up a recurring payment today. Just go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope. Only on 3CR 855am digital and 3cr.org.au. Let's cook.
Well, we hope that you're still listening to the Dogs program here on 3CR. And now we've got Sorrel, who's got an interesting article from Chris Bonner from Save Our Schools. Over to you, Sorrel.
Thanks, Jean. This article was written by Brett Henneberry, originally published in The Educator, and is titled How Australia Can Create an Equal School System. While successive governments have launched reviews and inquiries into the issue, structural reform remains to be seen. However, a new report points to a path forward, drawing inspiration from Canada's education model. Based on a landmark study tour of Ontario, the Australian Learning Lecture Report reveals how needs-based funding, inclusive enrolment, and a common framework across all sectors can deliver both equity and excellence. Pointing to Ontario's sector-blind, needs-based funding model as a blueprint for Australia, the report's authors say that with the right structures, regulations, and funding in place, Australia can build an equal school system. In Ontario, all publicly funded schools, whether secular or faith-based, operate under a common legislative and financial framework, are prohibited from charging fees, and must accept students of all backgrounds and abilities. This approach has reduced social segregation, lifted student achievement, and enjoyed broad political and community support. By contrast, Australia's three-tiered system entrenches inequality and limits opportunity, the report says. In their research, the report's co-authors, Tom Greenwell and Chris Bonner, found that Ontario's fair, inclusive school system is not only possible, it works. All the province's schools, including faith-based ones, operate under a common framework that funds schools based on student need, not sector, making the system equitable, effective, and affordable. Meanwhile, Quebec faces similar challenges to Australia's, but parents there are pushing for a more inclusive system. In British Columbia, some fee regulations exist, but inequities still persist. Overall, the report shows that Canada is doing a better job at building schools where every child, regardless of background, has the chance to thrive in their local community. Greenwell said the report's findings have some big implications for education policymakers and school leaders in Australia, which he said can learn from Ontario's model, which shows that when schools are resourced equitably, they're better positioned to serve all students, regardless of background. Australian principals are so often in the unenviable position of having to perform the dual role of educational leader and chief marketing officer, Greenwell told The Educator. This is especially difficult for principals who have fewer resources to accomplish a more challenging educational task than neighbouring schools. Greenwell said the Ontario model shifts the focus of principals from marketing to pedagogy, from sorting human talent to developing human potential. Because all schools are resourced according to need and regulated on the same basis, enrollment competition is less fierce and much fairer, he said. This means school leaders spend less energy on recruiting the right students and have the time and space to focus on building up the students in front of them. Another key challenge Australian leaders continue to face is navigating sector-based competition, which is often tied to enrolment, funding, and performance pressures. When asked what lessons he observed in Ontario about how school leaders maintain their school's distinct identity and appeal without resorting to exclusionary practices or fee-based strategies, Greenwell pointed to Ontario's schools that build distinctiveness through inclusive ethos and curriculum. Faith traditions, French language pathways, or forward-leaning stance on AI, rather than fees or selective enrollment. For Notre Dame High in Ottawa, the absence of exclusionary practices and fees is actually essential to its distinctive identity, Greenwell said. The school's motto is a place for everyone, and you only have to look at the range of initiatives they've introduced to support their very disadvantaged student community to see that they walk the talk. Greenwell noted that for Notre Dame's high school community, there is also a faith element to this: religious studies, a prayer on the loudspeaker every morning, and services in the chapel. In other parts of Ontario, it's the French language curriculum that defines the school community. In other schools, the unique identity might be something different altogether, approaching AI as an opportunity to be exploited as much as a threat to be minimized, for example, he said. In Ontario, schools are unique because they have a distinctive ethos or curriculum, but not because they benefit from better resourcing or exclude children facing greater challenges. Australia's education system often puts principals in government schools under growing pressure to compensate for structural inequities, adding to the stress of a profession already in crisis. The study's co-author, Chris Bonner, says while Australia has always had cross-sectoral professional bodies and collaboration at different levels, our unlevel playing field on which our schools compete undermines professional trust and collaboration. In Ontario, we didn't see evidence of ongoing antagonism between secular and Catholic schools or boards, Bonner told The Educator. The problems they have are overwhelmingly problems they have in common, and their solutions are shared. Bonner said emerging issues are much easier to deal with because the rules and obligations are the same for all publicly funded schools. If we get that right in Australia, the rest will follow. When asked what he learned from the study about teacher workload, collaboration, and professional learning that could inform how Australian systems better support teachers in diverse and inclusive classrooms, Bonner pointed to Ontario's equitable system of needs-based funding, which he said reduces the extent of concentrated disadvantage. The obligations and rules that come with the funding ensure that such concentrations are minimised. Accordingly, the responsibility for lifting the strugglers is much more evenly spread, he said. In contrast, some of our teachers, far more than others, bear the brunt of concentrated disadvantage, partly as a consequence of the unlevel playing field. Bonner said while there are many ways Australian systems can better support teachers, the priority should be to create more diverse and inclusive classrooms. Unless the equity gaps between schools are reduced, the benefits of any support will be limited. Back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Sorrel. But meanwhile, over in the private sector, they've been getting billions and billions of dollars of public money, particularly the Catholic school system, but they're not paying their teachers with it. Wonder what they're doing with it. Here is Dale, who's going to tell us about a few rescue teachers in the Catholic education system. Over to you, Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Noel Tao titled Catholic School Teachers Chase 37% Pay Rise. Hundreds of Victorian Catholic school principals are in open revolt against church education authorities over their approach to pay talks with the sector's 30,000 teachers. The pay row between teachers at the state's 493 Catholic schools and their employers is set to intensify in the coming weeks when the main workplace union, the Independent Education Union, lodges a pay claim worth 37% over 3 years. The teachers who say they are paid up to 13% less than their interstate counterparts also want a $5,000 sign-on bonus for each educator, regular retention bonuses worth 5% of their wage, and a 17% superannuation contribution. The present workplace deals expire in December, but the two sides can't even agree on the basis for negotiations. The employers' umbrella group, the Victorian Catholic Education Authority, VCEA, has insisted that the 34 separate church-linked entities that run schools in the state bargain separately with their individual workforces. The teachers want a single sector-wide bargaining process, which would grant them the right to strike, but the authority says the union's pursuit of a single interest bargaining is preventing wage talks from getting underway. If no resolution can be reached, the union says it will ask the Fair Work Commission to impose a sector-wide bargaining model on the employers, a move that would set a scene for school strikes in 2026 if a wage deal is not struck. A group of union members representing 200 principals took aim at the authority this week, accusing it of intransigence, stubbornness, and a disrespect for the teaching workforce. In a statement, the union's principals' council said the authority's position, which it maintained during past bargaining rounds, denied Catholic teachers their basic industrial and democratic rights. The union's Victorian Deputy General Secretary, Kylie Busk, told The Age that school leaders were caught in the middle of the mounting tension between teachers and their employers. The intransigent position of the Victorian Catholic education employers has put principals in a really difficult position, Busk said. The statement they have made reinforces the clear messages we've been getting from all our members in the sector. They demand a fair playing field and know that the only way to get it is through single interest bargaining. We call on Victorian Catholic employers to show some respect for their staff and to heed Catholic social justice teachings. But Victorian Catholic Education Authority Chief Executive Elizabeth Labone said the union's insistence on single interest bargaining was delaying a pay rise for its members. VCEA has invited the unions to begin negotiations, Labone said. We are sitting at the table waiting. The sooner those negotiations start, the sooner we can work through the potential mix of wages and conditions and get those benefits to employees. VCEA strongly believes that working productively within the current cooperative workplace agreement framework is the most effective and efficient way to deliver benefits to employees as soon as possible. Independent Education Union General Secretary David Breer said that the pay and conditions in the draft log of claims were no more than Catholic school teachers deserved. Since our last agreement was negotiated, cost of living pressures have exploded, and we've seen education unions interstate win very significant salary outcomes, Breer said. wages in Victorian Catholic schools have fallen way behind rates paid in other states. Teachers need increases of up to 13% to catch up to New South Wales rates, and we've just seen teachers in Queensland walk off the job to demand decent pay increases. We have major school staffing shortages, and there's a clear need for big salary increases for teachers, support staff, and leaders in Victorian schools if we're going to attract and retain the staff we need to continue delivery of quality education to our students. So, the Catholic Church not paying its teachers. Surprised? Back to you, Jean.
Well, that was very interesting, wasn't it? Let's have a break, shall we?
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, we hope you're still with us here on the Dogs Program, because now we're going overseas with our special researcher. Here is Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. And as we follow the chaotic clown show known as the Trump administration, it remains the biggest story in things which affect public education internationally. We're going to kick off with this article from the Huffington Post. It's called "The Trump Administration Move Will Destroy the Lives of Countless Kids." It's by Ryan W. Powers and dates from the 17th of August 25. He says, "The legal landscape shifted sharply with the return of the Trump administration, and I found myself with a front row seat to an unsettling reality. I dropped out of high school 2 weeks before the start of my senior year. It wasn't planned. A few failed classes turned into a quiet slide out of the system. Like too many students, I fell through the cracks. A few weeks later, I got a job with a mobile veterinary clinic serving low-income neighbourhoods across the mid-Atlantic. We'd set up in a strip mall, parking lots and tractor supply back rooms, vaccinating and microchipping dozens of pets each shift. I was 18, wrestling 120-pound German shepherds and coming home with dirt and blood on my scrubs. One day, a bite sent me to the ER for sutures up my side. Still, I loved it. When things slowed down as my friends applied to college, one thing became increasingly clear. Without a degree, the road ahead would be narrower, steeper, and far less forgiving. Finishing school felt like the difference between having choices and getting left behind. So I hit the books. I relied on public libraries and free online resources that entire year. I earned my GED in the basement of a community college and spent the next few months reading whatever I could get my hands on. Vintage paperbacks, old textbooks, open access PDFs. Eventually, I started poking through Supreme Court opinions. The more I read, the more engrossed I became. I was captivated by the stakes of it all, especially the idea that law, when done right, could be a support system. I applied to nearly two dozen colleges. One said yes, and I started over. I studied relentlessly, graduated at the top of my class, and went on to Harvard Law School. As a practicing attorney, one of my first major cases was representing a student with learning disabilities. This girl was in the seventh grade and had an individualised education plan. Under federal law, the school district was required to provide targeting reading help, one-on-one tutoring, and regular check-ins to help her stay on track. Instead, administrators terminated her mandated behavioural support plan and rolled back her test-taking accommodations. My job was to work with the Department of Education to make the district follow the law. When I first took on her case, the DOE, Department of Education, still had the will and resources to hold schools accountable. It felt like the kind of fight where the system, if pushed, could still work. For me, it was deeply personal, a chance to turn my own experiences into something useful. But the legal landscape shifted sharply with the return of the Trump administration, and I found myself with a front row seat to an unsettling reality. In May, the Trump administration released its financial year 2026 budget proposal. The plan calls for a $12 billion cut to the Department of Education, about 15% of the department's total. A central feature is the consolidation of 18 competitive and formula grant programs, including those serving English learners and migrant students, from $6.5 billion into a $2 billion K-12 simplified funding program. That figure represents a roughly 70% cut from current levels, effectively shrinking targeted investments in vulnerable student populations. The budget negatively impacts programs that fund education research, preschool access, and workforce training. gutting the data, early intervention and career readiness efforts that help close the learning gaps. Without these programs, the Department of Education leaves struggling schools with fewer resources and less accountability. Simultaneously, Trump has unleashed multiple executive orders to suppress federal diversity, equity and inclusion efforts. These orders dismantle DEI programs across the federal government, withdraw federal recognition of transgender identities and ban gender ideology instruction in K-12 schools, while authorising prosecution of educators supporting transgender students. Taken together, these measures strip away targeted funding streams, dismantle enforcement infrastructure, and narrow the pathways that have historically helped disenfranchised students overcome systemic barriers. For students, that impact will be immediate and structural. Deep budget cuts and program consolidations have left the Department of Education without the staff or resources to keep pace. Backlogs will grow, and the pressure on school districts to follow IEPs will evaporate. That means cancelled therapy sessions, long evaluation delays, or the quiet removal of key accommodations. Low-income and rural students, heavily reliant on federal funding, will feel the shift hardest. A missed tutoring session in middle school can cascade into failing grades and limited options years later. I know what it means to rely on public education systems. Free libraries, subsidised tutoring programs and early intervention services carried me to my GED. Without them, I might never have made it to college, let alone law school. For the seventh grade student I represented, the difference between the Department of Education I knew and the Department of Education she faces now is stark. Every month of backlog is another month without the support she needs, and we have allowed those delays to become the norm. It's not just about students with learning disabilities, it's about what happens when political leaders charged with enforcing rights are hostile to them, and the protections that once felt guaranteed slowly lose their power. What should be guaranteed in law is no longer carried out in practice. That's the end of the article. I'm going to do one now from that appeared first in USA Today, and it's written by Brianna J. Frank. Dates from the 6th of August 2025. Goes to the squabble over whether or not Arkansas can put the Ten Commandments in each classroom. It actually dates back a couple of weeks, but it's an important article. She says, a federal judge bars Arkansas public schools from displaying the Ten Commandments. And she begins, the federal judge called the law obviously unconstitutional and said passing it was likely part of a coordinated strategy to inject Christian religious doctrine into public schools. A federal judge on August 4th barred several Arkansas school districts from implementing what he described as plainly unconstitutional state law requiring public schools to display the Ten Commandments in their classrooms and libraries. The preliminary injunction, a temporary measure that maintains the status quo until a court hears the merits of the case, was issued a day before the Arkansas Act 573 was set to go into effect. US District Court Judge Timothy Brooks wrote that the Protestant displays would unconstitutionally violate the right to free exercise of religion, as well as the Establishment Clause, a provision of the First Amendment that prohibits the government from favouring religion over non-religion. He noted that the US Supreme Court struck down a nearly identical law in Kentucky in 1980. Why would Arkansas pass an obviously unconstitutional law, he wrote. Most likely because the state is part of a coordinated strategy among several states to inject Christian religious doctrine into public school classrooms. He went on to say that such states, including Louisiana and Texas, may be taking such measures in light of the Supreme Court's recent rulings in favour of religious expression and accommodation in public spaces. Several civil liberties groups, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, the American Civil Liberties Union of Arkansas, the ACLU and the Freedom from Information from Religion Foundation, and the New York-based law firm Simpson, Thatcher and Bartlett LLP are representing the plaintiffs, a group of multi-faith families with children in Arkansas public schools. The Fayetteville, Springdale, Bentonville and Siloam Springs School districts are defendants in the case. The state of Arkansas, on behalf of the Attorney General Tim Griffin, is listed as an intervener in the case, a third party who's not part of the original lawsuit but requests to get involved. Following Brooke's order, Griffin told Axios he was reviewing the court's order and assessing our legal options. Republican Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders also disagreed with the order. In Arkansas, we do in fact believe that murder is wrong and stealing is bad, Sanders told Axios. It is entirely appropriate to display the Ten Commandments on the basis of all Western law and morality as a reminder to students, state employees, and every Arkansan who enters a government building. And that's the end of the article. So, yes, the trend continues of the rising of the Christian right loony section of the community, and they're taking over the Christian fascists, seem to be on the up, as we know. This next article is one from The 74, and The 74 is an online blog which supports public education, and The 74 refers to the 74 million Americans who are under 18. And this is an article by Joe Napolitano from August the 8th. And it is that Trump's call to remove undocumented from the census could impact education funding. He writes, if fewer people are counted, federal funding for schools, which is based on census data and child poverty rates, would shrink, experts say. He writes, President Donald Trump has proposed removing undocumented people from an upcoming US census, a move that, while difficult to execute, could dramatically reduce school funding in some states, experts say. In an early morning Truth Social post Thursday, Trump said he told the US Department of Commerce to begin work on a new census based on the modern-day facts and figures, adding, people who are in our county, or in our country, sorry, illegally, will not be counted in the census, written in caps. The US census count is held once a decade and helps determine federal education funding. Bruce Baker, a professor at the University of Miami and a leading scholar on public school financing, said that if fewer people are counted, federal funding for schools, which is based on census data and child poverty rates, would shrink. The states that depend more on federal aid have the most to lose, he said. And while the percentage of such aid is relatively small, he said, these days every dollar matters. Pew Research reports the federal government provided 13.6% of total funding for public elementary and secondary schools in fiscal year 2022, according to Census Bureau data. The National Education Association said the money helps lower class size and supports students with disabilities and feeds hungry children. It breaks down the data by state. Other studies confirm federal education funding varies widely across the US, Mississippi. Mississippi recorded the greatest percentage of federal education aid in 2022, coming in at 23.3%, followed by South Dakota at 21.7%, Montana at 20.9%, Alaska at 20.6%, and Arkansas at 20.4%. The federal money is delivered to schools in many forms. In fiscal year 24, Pew notes, the Education Department doled out $18.8 billion for schools with large numbers of poor, neglected, delinquent and other educationally disadvantaged students, $15.5 billion for special education programs for children with disabilities, $5.5 billion for school improvement and a $2.2 billion amount for career, technical and adult education, among many other grants. The federal government also spent billions of dollars on COVID recovery. Trump's call to revise the census comes amid massive cutbacks at the Education Department, changing how critical programs are implemented, and towards the end of a nail-biting summer, with many in education gripped by fear after the administration temporarily withheld $7 billion in funding. It also comes just weeks after he announced undocumented children could no longer participate in Head Start, which is a help-up program. In addition, adults without papers were banned from career and technical education programs and adult education, though both groups now have a brief reprieve. The nation is home to some 11 million undocumented immigrants. California has 2.6 million such residents in 2022, followed by Texas with more than 2 million and Florida, which has 590,000, according to data released last year. This isn't the first time Trump has tried to tinker with the US census. In his first term, he proposed the addition of a citizenship question, one critics say would have resulted in a dramatic undercount and produced a massive loss of funding in immigrant-heavy communities where even those in the country illegally would be fearful of responding. The matter made its way to the Supreme Court, with Chief Judge Justice John Roberts casting the deciding vote against the addition. Julia Galat, Associate Director of the US Immigration Policy Program at the Migration Policy Institute, said Trump could try to obtain residents' immigration status in two ways, add questions about citizenship to the census itself, as he earlier proposed, or try to pull information from other federal data. In either case, she said, undocumented immigrants and those who live, work and study alongside them would lose out. If there are more people in a community, there is more need for infrastructure, she said. US citizens would be hurt if that funding was insufficient. However, Trump's census plan would be difficult to enact, and it's unclear when it would be implemented. Population counts take several years to plan. Also, Congress, not the president, determines the matter of conducting the tally. Trump's intention to exclude undocumented immigrants from the census, coupled with his earlier attack on birthright citizenship, is enough to roll those concerned about the dignity of all US residents. If you don't count all people, you won't be able to provide equal protection to all people, said Alexandra Vasquez Bauer, a fellow with the Century Foundation. So this plan is to not count undocumented people is a clear abandonment of that constitutional promise of equal protection. And with each new edict targeting the undocumented, she said, she fears the nation will inch closer to a direct attack on Plyer versus Doe, the landmark 1982 Supreme Court ruling that a child cannot be denied a public education based on immigration status. Hayward Derek Horton, a professor of sociology at the University of Albany, said the census impacts all districts, all areas of civic life, calling it the engine that makes society work. He noted too that the US Census is the gold standard for data collection and is respected globally. So what's being threatened is not only the integrity of what this society is about in terms of being able to know exactly how many people we have and the allocations of the right resources to the right places, but it also invalidates this society to the world. Horton said he believes the fear of losing a numerical majority and the power and money that comes with it is driving these efforts to erase an entire group, in this case, mostly Hispanic immigrants, from the census. White people comprised 80% of the total US population in 1980. Recent reports put the current figure at less than 60%. White residents will no longer be the majority by 2045, the Brookings Institute reported. Here in the US, the white population controls the wealth, status and power, and they also control the numbers, he said. And that's the end of the article. It goes along with Trump's decision recently to ban the people who collect labour statistics because he didn't like the numbers that came up. And so now they're looking like instead of putting out monthly figures for jobs and things like that, they're only putting them out every 3 months is the proposal. And the guy they've hired to do it is one of the Gen 6 guys who was along for the ride at the Capitol. And he's as MAGA as they come. Anyway, with those sort of grim news details, I might pass you back to the headquarters of the Dogs and wish you all a very fine weekend. And as the Canadians say, elbows up. Cheerio.
Well, we'd like to have a bit of good news. And here's Andy with a bit of good news, believe it or not, from America. There's been a lot of banning of books you might have read, but there's a judge over there who said no. Over to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Victory for rights to read. Federal judge guts major portion of Florida's book ban in a blow to DeSantis. A judge said a law allowing parents to challenge books over purportedly pornographic content was overbroad and unconstitutional. And this was published on MSNBC News on August the 15th. A federal judge has closed the chapter on key parts of Florida's censorious ban on school library books that conservatives deem pornographic and harmful to children. Amid a broader assault on diversity in the state, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed a law in 2023, known as House Bill 1069, that set up a process for parents to challenge books for removal from school libraries that they feel are unsuitable for young readers. The repressive law requires that schools remove books within 5 days of a parent's complaint and make them unavailable while they're reviewed. The process, broadly targeting books with pornographic content or that describe sexual conduct, has ensnared many titles by non-white and LGBTQ authors over purported obscenity. Last year, multiple publishing companies, Florida parents and authors filed a lawsuit seeking to thwart the bill, naming as defendants various members of the State Education Board and school boards in Orange and Volusia counties, and the suit appears to have succeeded in large part. By enacting HB 1069, the Florida legislature sought to prohibit material from entering or remaining in school libraries that is not obscene for minors, District Court Judge Carlos Mendoza said in his ruling on Wednesday, which found the section that targets descriptions of sexual conduct to be unconstitutional. He listed several examples. The following books, among others, have been removed: The Color Purple, Half of a Yellow Sun, Cloud Atlas, The Splendid and the Vile, I Am Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, The Freedom Writer's Diary, How a Teacher and 150 Teens Used Writing to Change Themselves and the World Around Them, On the Road, 19 Minutes, Paper Towns, Looking for Alaska, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, The Kite Runner, Slaughterhouse-Five, Shout, Last Night at the Telegraph Club, The Handmaid's Tale, Native Son, Kaffir Boy, The True Story of a Black Youth's Coming of Age in Apartheid South Africa, Water for Elephants, Beloved, Song of Solomon, The Bluest Eye, and Homegoing. None of these books are obscene. The judge said the law's focus on books that describe sexual content is overbroad and unconstitutional, and he said the law mandates the removal of books that contain even a single reference to the prohibited subject matter, regardless of the holistic value of the book individually or as part of a larger collection. Mendoza also rejected conservatives' argument that libraries and the books in them are forums for government speech. He wrote that many removals at issue here are the objecting parent's speech, not the government's, and that slapping the label of government speech on book removals only serves to stifle the disfavoured viewpoints. Citing Supreme Court precedent, the judge said, "To be sure, parents have the right to direct the upbringing and education of children, but the government cannot repackage their speech and pass it off as its own." Mendoza declined to strike down the law completely, writing that the law's reference to pornographic content can be read as synonymous with content considered harmful to minors under Florida law, which means some books could still be banned, but only if they meet a rigorous standard for obscenity known as the Miller Test. The Authors Guild, which was a plaintiff in the suit and claims to represent more than 16,000 members, called the ruling a sweeping victory for readers and authors. State officials said they plan to appeal the ruling. And I hope they lose, but in the current day, I can't be sure of that. Back to you, Jean.
Yes, well, we got to have a bit of good news towards the end, but we'd like to refer you to an article which we gave you back on the 28th of June. It was called Diplomatic Insolence. It came from the Monthly. And it was a really good story about, or memory really, down memory lane for Morgan Campbell, who went to a selective school in Newcastle, which we'll be hearing about a bit later. And she went down to Sydney University and was involved in this imitation of the United Nations. And she caused a bit of a stir, more or less saying at the end of the day with all these private school kids who she gave a run for their money, that it was all pretty useless. Fighting the good fight for a repressive pariah state, weightless in righteous abstraction, I hadn't learned anything, because she had been the representative for Iran. But we'd like to refer you to that, and you might find it on the 3CR website, on our podcast there, on the 28th of June. We'd like to take you now to our great state school, which is a selective high school in Newcastle that Morgan Campbell went to. The really good thing about selective high schools is that when students from there come up against the children from places like Cranbrook or Scots College and they try to pull the class distinction, somebody who's been told that they're pretty bright and they can do anything in the world, which the selective high school children are told, they don't take it. They don't take too well to the class structure of Australian society at all. And I think this was what the Diplomatic Insolence article was about. And I must say that as a product of such a school, Fort Street in Sydney, I can understand this. I think it tends to make you into an inverted snob. I'm not sure whether that's a good or a bad thing. Let's hear from Andy about our good state school for the week, shall we?
Every week on the Doctor Program, we have a special segment to show a different state school is a great school.
State schools are great schools.
School of the week.
State school.
School of the week.
Great state schools.
State schools.
School of the week.
School for the week here on the Dogs Program.
And this week's great state school of the week is Merriweather High School. And their website includes an article about the value of public schools. For 175 years, New South Wales public schools have prepared the children of today to succeed and build better communities for tomorrow. Across almost every industry, you will see our alumni leading the way, from Reserve Bank governors to High Court judges, experts in health, education, construction, and international film and sports stars. Why are public schools the best choice? Our public schools offer a comprehensive tuition-free education that lays the foundation for a lifetime of learning and success. Our students consistently feature as the most successful performers in the New South Wales HSE, and we perform above the national average in NAPLAN results. In fact, over 50 of our students achieved top positions in the state for their HSC subjects in 2023, a testament to the quality of our education. With more than 140,000 dedicated staff across 2,200 schools in the state, which includes teachers recognised as some of the best in Australia, our students can access cutting-edge resources from expert teachers who help them thrive. Our students can also participate in specialty programs that include vocational education, dance, drama, music, visual arts, literature, debating, and public speaking. We provide exciting opportunities to broaden our students' horizons through language programs, cultural exchange, and international competitions. We celebrate our rich diversity, which supports our local communities and helps create well-rounded global citizens. The impact of public school excellence is evident across our schools, students, and alumni. From students representing Australia on international platforms to alumni revolutionising assistive technology. Not to mention the wealth of Australian athletes the public school system has produced. Choose your local public school. If you're looking for a school with high quality education and a proven track record of academic, sporting and cultural excellence, choose a New South Wales public school. To find the right school close to your home, use School Finder. Take a glimpse of the magic that happens in our schools each and every day to inspire our students to achieve highly. Merriweather High School is an academically selective high school catering for 1,080 students from a wide geographical area within the Hunter Central Coast region. The school offers a broad, balanced and relevant curriculum focusing on high expectations of student academic achievement. Merriweather High School is committed to developing the whole student through academic, civic, sporting and cultural opportunities and representation. Students are strongly encouraged to participate in leadership, creative and performing arts programs and sporting pursuits, along with a range of extracurricular activities, as well as their academic development and pursuits. The school has high expectations of every student, consistent with each student's ability and with the belief that all students are capable of achieving their personal best. Experienced staff supports the needs of our academically gifted and talented students. A significant feature of the school is that it is a caring community, committed to excellence, diversity, and fostering individual talents. The development of technology is ongoing with continued access to applications that enhance teaching and learning. The school has an active parent body that supports the school through a variety of programs. Merriweather High School has established a number of important links with the community to strengthen student outcomes by supporting student academic and welfare development. Our three core values are pride, respect, and responsibility. And now some facts and figures from the ACARA My Schools website. Enrolment is 1,203 and the ICSEA value above average at 1,075, representative of a flourishing urban and regional community. Upper 25% of parental income accounts for 72% of students. That second quartile, 19% of students. The third quartile, i.e. below average parental income, 7%, and the lowest quartile of family incomes, 2%, with 33% speaking a language other than English and 2% Indigenous. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian government of $3.4 million and from the Victorian government, $12.8 million. Fees and contributions are $1.2 million and other private contributions, $161,000. That works out at $16,571 per pupil. The capital, $5.22 million over 3 years, and the NEPLAN results are well above average, an extraordinary high school. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to Merriweather High School up there in Newcastle, and also congratulations to Morgan Campbell for her article in the Monthly. And, well, I suppose I now have to sign off. It's time that I reminded you about our website, which is www.adogs.info, and thank Dale and, of course, Andy and Sorrel and Jeff. But from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.